Welcome back to another episode of the CSK8 podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. In this week's episode, I'm interviewing Chris Woods. Chris is a fellow podcaster with the STEM Everyday podcast and has a website called dailystem.com, which has a ton of free resources that I highly recommend for anyone interested in STEM or STEAM. Although this week's episode primarily focuses on STEM, much of our discussions are certainly applicable to CS education. In particular, our discussions center around the importance of contextualizing STEM through everyday connections. This is something that CS educators should also really pay attention to. So whenever Chris is talking about STEM or STEAM, I highly recommend thinking about, well, what would this look like in computer science education? Other topics that we engage in also include leveraging student interests. We discuss blurring boundaries between subject areas, the affordances and constraints of the acronym STEM or STEAM, continuing to learn in your everyday by asking questions, as well as Chris's new book titled Daily STEM, How to Create a STEM Culture in Your Classrooms and Communities, and so much more. As always, you can find links to many of the things that we discuss in the show notes, which you can find at jaredoleary.com, or by simply clicking on the link in your app. With all that being said, we will now begin with an introduction by Chris.
Hi there, I'm Chris Woods. I'm a high school math teacher and also the founder of Daily STEM and dailystem.com and Daily STEM on all the social medias. And one of my biggest goals, not just as an educator in my own classroom, but in every opportunity that I can to try to help educators make STEM more relevant, make it more practical, and especially help to build that STEM culture into their classrooms, their whole school, and their community.
So can you tell me the story of how you got into STEM education?
I would say that as a kid, I had a natural sense of wonder, like most kids do. And I love to be able to make things. I love to be able to create and build and take things apart and put things back together. Playing with Legos as a kid is one of those things that builds a lot of STEM skills into a lot of kids. We'd build tree forts, me and my brother. As we grow up, I was very influenced by just spending time with my grandparents and seeing the different things that they do each and every day, or thinking of the different jobs that my parents did, thinking about how is all these things that I really like science and math and technology kind of things, how is it relevant in the real world? So I was a good student, ended up as a teacher, ended up as a math teacher, and I wanted to bring those real life aspects to my students. So that was kind of my reason for wanting to get a hold of this STEM acronym, which I think a lot of people still are kind of confused about, and try to make it really practical to my students, especially to show them the connections of the things that we're learning in the classroom. So my whole story of how I got into STEM education is really just based on becoming a teacher, wanting to help the kids see that what they were learning in the classroom is real. You know, the whole, when are we ever going to use this stuff anyway question.
One of the things that I frequently talk about is the importance of contextualized learning in the classroom. And far too often we engage in subject areas where it's just, it doesn't have any real world application. And the one of the things that I particularly appreciated with your website, your YouTube channel, and just like your other resources, it's here's this very practical thing that's related to STEM that you might not have been even aware of. One of the videos you were talking about magnetism with brakes and cars and whatnot, like that's something that we used to use all the time when we were actually going out.
And just thinking through those everyday things that we see every day, whether we're an educator or a parent, how can we point those things out to our kids? If we're an educator, pull out that phone out of your pocket and snap a picture of stuff and then take that back to the classroom and say, look at this that I saw. What do you notice? What do you think? What do you wonder? How does it work? Does it open up any other questions? What do you want to learn about? Could you imagine doing this? So many things that build off of questions that kids ask.
What's been interesting, not being like an education historian, but it seems like STEM has kind of been a very important acronym or at least a set of subjects ever since Sputnik in particular, where it's like, oh, wow, other people are doing things that we haven't done yet. And so we as a country need to focus more on these particular areas. However, in like recent decade or so, it's like STEM has been at the forefront of we need more funding, we need more training for teachers and for students, etc. But I'm curious, if someone were to ask you, like, what are some problems that can be solved with STEM, what would you say to them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jared, because I think a lot of educators feel that way. Like, what can I do? How can I start? And frankly, it's great when educators start with just those simple projects that they see, like we're going to take toothpicks or straws or spaghetti and marshmallows and gumdrops or whatever we can and build tall towers. Now, those are great. Those are the simple entry points that every teacher needs to start to feel confident with STEM. Because if you just set a 3D printer in front of an educator and say, there you go, now that's STEM in your classroom, they're going to be intimidated. They're not going to have confidence. They're going to feel like they don't have any training. So I think we really need to build that up for every educator to say, okay, what's something I could do this week to incorporate some simple, practical STEM thing into my classroom? Maybe it's, we're going to take the kids around the school and pick up all the trash. And then we're going to think about all the different types of trash we saw and say, what kind of recommendations could we make to the city council? What kind of recommendations could we make to the food service at our school to maybe limit some of those things? That's a simple thing. It doesn't require any funds, even much pre-planning. It's just, let's, you know, maybe throw some rubber gloves on, grab some trash bags, and let's go do that. I think that there's a lot of little problems inside every school, or even the kids could bring from their home or their neighborhood, things that they could say, let's try to tackle this problem. Then you've especially increased that relevance aspect as well.
That really resonates with me. I recently recorded like a little mini series on Paulo Freire's book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And so one of the things that he talks about in that book in particular is like a problem-posing approach to education and the importance of that and making it so that you're solving problems that actually matter. And so your example of like picking up trash around the school, that is an example that I can think of with that. So that definitely resonates with me. Do you have any other advice for like educators who are like interested in getting started, but they might have some reluctant kids who are just like, I'm not really interested in this thing. How is this relevant to me or the things that I care about?
Yeah, exactly, Jared, because I think a lot of educators know that some of their kids are going to say, I'm just like us as adults often say, well, I'm not really a math person or a science person.
Right.
You know, I couldn't be a writer, you know, but I think if we remind kids that the writing process where you write a rough draft, you change it, you modify it, you make it better. Well, that's exactly what we do in iteration when we're creating something and inventing something and solving a problem. And it's also the same thing that we do when we're doing the scientific method. We're making a hypothesis, we're drawing conclusions, going back and refining our hypothesis. So number one, if kids are like, I don't like math or I don't like science, connect and show them how it connects to the things they're already doing. If a kid has a love for history though, find a way to connect the STEM aspects to history. Look for interesting ways that historians are finding archaeological sites or renovating old things to preserve and protect. Find your kids' passions and leverage those to unlock the STEM potential in a kid. That's going to be the number one thing. And us as educators, we need to know, what are our kids interested in? What drives them? What gets them excited every day?
I like that. One of the themes that kind of became apparent in a lot of the stuff that you put out on your resources, like on your website and whatnot, is the importance of bringing home this learning and connecting as a family to talk about it. And I'm curious if you have some suggestions for educators who are interested in trying to make that connection between at-school learning and at-home learning with the family.
Yeah, you mentioned resources that I have on my website, and I'm not trying to sell anything here. I mean, but definitely, because I've got all my resources on my site for free, lists of 77 ideas, you know, multiple lists of simple things that any family can do together, whether that's, and oftentimes it's just that reminder that parents need, because parents might not feel like they're rocket scientists, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do STEM. So you can just give parents a list. Maybe you print out the list as an educator, and then you share a couple each week and say, hey, parents, here's five. Pick one of these to do with your kids this week. You know, go outside and look at the stars, or how many bugs are in you can find in your backyard, or go for a walk and how many different animals or types of trees or things do you see? Go to a nature preserve, whatever you've got in your neighborhood. And again, that allows every kid to be able to experience STEM, not just the kids that have, you know, resources at home, like a 3D printer or fancy technology at home. Every kid can do STEM with a little bit of creativity. And again, those resources are on my website, dailystem.com. You can just click on them, download them as PDFs. They can share them. They're in multiple languages, even thanks to great people that have translated those. That can often just get it started. There's obviously more things you can do, like parent nights and things like that. But that's just a great first step to just start getting parents excited.
Yeah, I like that. If listeners haven't heard the episode yet, I did an interview with Peter Rich and Stacey Mason, where we talked about the research findings on computational thinking in the elementary space. And one of the important findings that they found that they hadn't really thought of was just how important that connection was with at-home learning. And like whether or not parents were encouraging and engaging that at home had a statistically significant impact on their level of retention and understanding of computational thinking in the schools.
Yeah. And Jared, if I can mention right there as well, if you think about, we've often told parents, read with your kids, read with your kids, read with your kids. You know, we have to be able to say, let's do STEM with our kids, do STEM with our kid. And again, it could be putting a puzzle together, playing a game, and actually making the kid do all the adding and counting for the money in Monopoly or anything like that. Or make your own game using all the broken pieces and parts of games that you've lost.
Yeah, just to normalize these processes, to make it so, no, this is just a normal thing that we do. This is a part of our everyday, which is why I love like your idea of daily STEM.
Yeah.
I'm curious if we were to flip this, though, if somebody were to ask like you to argue against STEM and when they should not learn STEM, what kind of arguments might you give?
Yeah. In fact, I mean, as much as I love the STEM acronym because it draws attention to all those aspects of education, those subjects, again, we just put like up another silo, more constructs of subjects, when really STEM is really just about connecting the learning in the world outside to the learning that's happening in the classroom. We need to find better ways of just making whatever content, whatever curriculum we're responsible for in our classroom and in our situation, make it more relevant to the kids, to their lives, to their world, whether that's science and technology and math, or whether it's English, reading, history, Spanish, social studies, whatever it is. I mean, I love to read. I love reading like historical fiction and just random things like that and biographies. I love reading stories. But you know what? I'm also a math person too. So you can have those reading, those math people. You know, we talk sometimes, oh, I'm right brain, I'm left brain, but we just need to help kids just use their brain.
Yeah, I like that. And a lot of what I have seen, forgive me if this is a false impression, but it seems like a lot of your resources are really great for informal learning and learning outside of school in particular.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot that are designed for like at home and family learning. However, in the classroom space, there's like you mentioned, those silos that are put up. So STEM, even though it's an acronym where all the letters are together, like it's often treated as, well, science is separate from technology, which is separate from engineering, which is separate from math. So what do you recommend for teachers who are trying to make those connections across and within those different silos?
Yeah, great question, Jared. So number one, I'm a math teacher. I'm a high school math teacher. I'm not like a quote unquote STEM teacher, the kids for a STEM class or anything. But what I do, of course, I'm showing my kids how my algebra that I'm teaching or geometry that I'm teaching connects to their world. But I'm also showing them how those things connect to digital marketing, how they connect to art, how they connect to business. I'll collaborate a lot of times, like if I come across a resource, especially that I happen to notice because it's mathy or sciencey, I share that with the art teacher if it's got a great artistic connection. And likewise, when she notices something, she shares it back with me, something that she knows that I might find enjoyable. And I think a lot of educators, if we just said, you know, I don't have to feel like I'm an expert or a know-it-all. All I'm doing is I'm just sharing a resource I came across with one of my colleagues. I'd want somebody to do that to me. So I'm just going to do it with them. And it's such a simple, powerful thing because we all see different things in our social media feeds or the websites that we go to. Instead of just having like one set of eyes looking for stuff that's great for your classroom, what if your whole school, your whole staff was looking for things that were great for your classroom?
I like that. I particularly would use reverse engineering practices to find new ideas for projects like to create with kids. So either while I was playing a video game or if I'd like watch something on YouTube, I'd be like, I wonder how I could make that in Scratch or in Swift or whatever, just to find those connections and like fun ways in engaging in computer science in particular.
That's also where on social media, when somebody posts a question, I love that when educators say, like just this afternoon, somebody asked me, hey, I'm going to be doing a unit on the Amazon. You know, so I'm instantly in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, this is probably like elementary teacher thinking about geography, thinking about social studies. And they're like, how could I connect some STEM things to it? Well, when teachers post those kinds of questions in their network, their professional learning network, they're instantly going to get resources and ideas from a lot of people. Again, it's that crowdsourcing does a whole lot more than just when it's that one person.
What about, have you had experience with any colleagues who are resistant to it? And I say this as somebody with a background in music education. And like, I think of some of my music ed colleagues who are like, technology doesn't have a place with quote, real instruments and whatnot. And it's like, well, I beg to differ.
Yeah, you'd beg to differ. So would I, Jared. Google Chrome Music Lab is an incredible resource that educators could use. The band OK Go makes amazing music videos, but they use science and technology, engineering and math to craft those videos to make them all work. Like they recorded a video in 4.5 seconds for one of their songs. And when they slowed down the frame rate, it all lined up to the beat. every single step. And the great thing is they've shared a bunch of that content on a website so educators can find it and use that. And again, leverage those interests, those passions that kids have to find new ways to say, oh yeah, this STEM, this math, the science, whatever I'm learning, it really does connect to things that I'm interested in. And, you know, we can just be patient. We'll convert the whole world to understand that STEM is part of the world.
Yeah, I like that. One advice that I have given to some teachers about that particular topic is find somebody who can be an advocate who also speaks their language. So with me, with my background in music education, I just say, just send it to me. I'll talk to them. Like, I'll send them Flight of the Bumblebee, where it's played on like this grid of buttons as opposed to on a piano. Like, they'll look at that and go, oh, wait, you're creating, quote, real music, but you just happen to be using a different tool for it.
So many neat things out there. And again, the internet is filled with so many super resources because, again, you've crowdsourced ideas and everybody is so creative. You know, everybody wants to be noticed on YouTube.
Yeah.
They're going to come up with the most creative thing they can. And all we have to do as educators is just sit back and find them.
So STEM as an acronym, like, is a bit constraining. So we've had some people who have tried to like add in the A for like arts. So now it's STEAM. We've also had like STEM plus C for computer science. So on that note, where do you see computer science potentially fitting in or complementing STEM?
Computer science is such an incredible aspect. And I think a lot of educators, of course, have jumped on the coding bandwagon. I mean, that's the quick, simple, you know, you ask any elementary teacher and they'll say, oh yeah, I've heard of coding. We do Hour of Code or a Code Week. And those are great because those are like those entry points to get all teachers realizing that computer science is so important. I think as kids grow up, though, they realize that coding is really more than just let's make a fun game when we're in elementary school. And I think if any educator that feels like they are good at computer science and have that basic knowledge of that, if they take some of those opportunities and say, oh yeah, here's how computer science is used to, you know, create this kind of program, this kind of app that solves a problem in our world.
Right.
Because everybody, face it right now, is using computer science, whether they think about it or not. As you would know, you would understand, it's built in, it's embedded to everything that we do nowadays because we've got a phone in our pocket that does all sorts of different things that we never imagined we could do while walking around or standing at a bus stop, you know? I mean, and it's all because of computer science. So show those kids those examples. Show them the new technology, show them a news story. I love showing news stories to my kids because that's like the front cutting edge. And we never could do that in the past because we'd have to wait till a new textbook came out, you know, 5 years from now till it had updated information. We've got an updated textbook right there on the internet and it's news stories each and every day.
Yeah. And we walk around with devices in our pockets with more computational power than everything it took to send somebody to the moon. So it's just amazing to think about that and then go, and here I am using it to text and listen to podcasts.
Yeah, which are both good. And for those kids that are, you know, just recording their videos of themselves or TikToks, you know, whatever it'll be by the time this podcast comes out. If we can help those kids also realize that that tool in their pocket is such a game breaker. I mean, it can do so much, not just to create their quote unquote brand of themselves to be an influencer, but to create, not just consume. You know, that's a big topic as well in education.
A lot of the subject areas that are within the acronym aren't typically known for being creation-based places. Like you mentioned contextualizing mathematics. I wish I had you as my math teacher because all my math teachers, it was decontextualized and I would just constantly be like, what's the point of this? I'm not actually making anything. I'm just solving different equations or problems. But I'm wondering, how do you challenge educators to think of STEM as a creative field and include other disciplines that are typically more creative, like the arts, humanities, etc.?
Honestly, it happens when you demonstrate it yourself. I mean, I guess that's maybe the simplest thing. And I can't maybe convince every teacher to be a different type of teacher, a better type of teacher. But like you said, when I share something on my social media, so like, let's say I post a picture on my Twitter and a few teachers look at it and they say, oh, that's a great idea. I never would have thought of cutting parallelograms out of old magazines and pasting them together on a piece of paper. And it gives that illusion because when you put three parallelograms together, it looks like a three-dimensional cube. And so you create this artistic picture that's very cool. Any kid can take home and hang it up on their wall in their room and be like, you know, that's some cool art that I made. It's also math. You can bring up all those aspects of, well, it worked because of the angles of the sides of that polygon, of that shape. And there's reasons that different types of polygons do that and other types of polygons that don't. then the kids start noticing. They're like, hey, Mr. Woods, I saw this picture, or I saw this graphic in my game, or I saw this background on a folder. And so I bought this one because it reminded me of what we talked about in our class. And that's the best part, when the kids start to realize that that STEM that you've been talking about and contextualizing it, as you said, Jared, when they start to see it in their world and bring it back to you and show you how they're starting to notice it.
So what kind of spaces do you think afford this kind of approach to connecting all these different disciplinary boundaries?
We're always, I think, until education radically changes, and we see education right now already changing with distance learning and those types of things. So change is possible in education. We've just proved it, you know, in 2020. But at some point, education, I think, will change to have less of those walls, those rigid lines between subject areas. In fact, I would love nothing more than there to never be a STEM teacher, because the moment that we just have, you know, STEM class, we walk down the hallway, we go to STEM class, then we walk back to our classroom, and then we do something else. I mean, it's great. I love that kids get to do that and experience that, especially because maybe that's the best way to share those resources and the expert maybe in your building. But that's not the focus of being a STEM school or having STEM materials and learning for your kids. We want that STEM to be part of every classroom. We want it to be part of every aspect. And again, same thing with literacy. One thing that I make each week for educators is like a weekly newspaper of just some STEM stories from news articles and a puzzle and a challenge and different things like that. Because I want kids to not just think that STEM is something that we do. It's also something that you read about. It has a literacy aspect to it as well. And I think the more that we can combine all these subjects, yeah, I'd love nothing more than in the future there to be a school, to be education that doesn't have so many boundaries in it.
So if somebody were to wave a magic wand and be like, okay, Chris, you get everything you want, design the ideal school, would it just be like one giant makerspace? Or like, how would you construct this hypothetical school?
You know, honestly, I think it all comes down to, no matter what kind of building you have, no matter what kind of resources you have, even what kind of subjects or electives you decide to teach, I think it comes down to two things. It comes down to passionate educators who love what they're doing and want to keep getting better and want to make education relevant for every kid. And then number two, it's got to come down to those kids rediscovering the wonder, the curiosity that they had when they were young. And often that wonder is pushed out in favor of worksheets. And instead, we need to recapture that wonder, that excitement for learning, that they're not just at a school to get grades. Grades have some sort of effect because they are the best way that we've come up with so far of saying, yes, you've mastered this. No, you haven't mastered this. You know, at some point, that'll probably change too. But if kids can regain that passion just for learning, I want to learn because this is something I'm interested about. I know the hard part is we don't have time machines for these kids to get in and go see the future self of them, where they'll know exactly what career or job they're doing. But they still have interests right now. And if we can help them just look at those interests and see how they connect with career focus, then they're going to say, okay, I want to learn this because it can help me to do some amazing things someday.
One of the things that I've kind of experienced in my tenure in education is like, it eventually got more about the things I was interested in. So when I started in like pre-K, kindergarten, it was all, here are the things that you need to know. I didn't really have a choice in it. It wasn't until my master's when it was like, oh, okay, now you're within this content area, like music psychology, what do you want to focus on within that? And then it wasn't until the doctorate when they're finally like, okay, what do you actually want to research and understand? And I don't understand like why it took like 20 some odd years until it finally was, okay, what do you want to learn? And we wonder why a lot of people just don't like education and don't like going to school. Well, perhaps it's because we wait until like 20 some odd years into this thing when we've beaten all that wonder and curiosity out of kids. And then we finally go, okay, what do you want to learn?
Again, I think a simple way that every educator can do that is have a board, have a poster board on the wall, something, somewhere where kids could write, this is something we want to learn about. This is something I'm interested in. Have every kid, you know, wherever they have their like notebook or whatever, a page in it that they can write, this is something I'm interested in. Because we forget, we're all forgetful. We move on to the next thing. We're, you know, oh, the new level of the game that I like just released and I want to play that. And I instantly forgot about something that I wanted to learn more about. So we watched a video and it was like, wow, that's cool. I'd love to learn more. Ooh, here's the next video. I'm going to click on that and you've forgotten. So we got to have those lists. We got to, you know, because kids are going to interrupt. They're going to say, what if we did this? Or would this work? You know, Mr. Woods, let's write it on the board. We'll get back to it. Because man, if we can pull out their interests and use those, then that's great.
So in our conversation and a lot of the resources, like The way that you talk is not just limited to the acronym of STEM. The subject areas that you bring into it, it is like well beyond those four subject areas. So I'm wondering if you could potentially like talk about some of the affordances and constraints of having it labeled as STEM, and maybe even propose, should we call it something else or just keep calling it STEM?
Well, I love adding the A in there for the arts. I love that. Even if you could add every other letter of the alphabet with it, it's great. Because you know what? Naturally, I see the arts in math, in science. I mean, I look at a cocoon, I look at a leaf, I look at a raindrop, and you know what? Yeah, there's science and math and even engineering and technology to that. But guess what? They are artistic. They are beautiful. They make a really cool sound when that raindrop hits the ground and goes plink or plop. But every one of those things, I mean, yeah, we could add all those letters to it. I just like the STEM acronym because I think it draws that focus of these are all these subjects that really do kind of connect together. And almost what it's doing is it's starting to say, maybe there isn't so much of a dividing line between math and science and technology and engineering, of course, too. I can teach math and I can also teach science with my certifications and stuff, but I'll always be asking the kids, well, what are you doing in science? Or this thing that we're doing right now in algebra is going to help you in chapter four in science, because I've built that connection with a science teacher at my school. I know what they're going to be doing. So it's already, I guess, it's saying all these things are kind of similar. Let's group them together. It's going to connect. But yeah, does history connect? Sure, it does. Does social studies connect? Yes. Does the arts? Does music? Does PE? Yes, it all connects. I think it just draws a great focus on all those very nerdy, geeky subjects, which are great words, by the way, nerdy and geeky. Just like a bookworm is a good descriptor too. I want kids to be proud of those terms, actually. I'm proud of to be all three of those. If we had to get rid of the STEM acronym, that's fine, because I'll just start talking about, let's make education relevant, because I think that's really what it really comes down to.
Yeah, part of that question is like a selfish question, because so when I was writing my dissertation, I was looking at this discussion forum at like over 10,000 people on it talking about making music with old video game hardware. And so when they were talking about it, they talk about like music composition and performance, the typical things you'd think about. But they also talked about, okay, how do I modify my old Game Boy to make it so that it has new audio ports? Like, how do I write a program to make it so I can actually can compose music with my Game Boy? So they're doing all this computer science stuff and like all this hardware engineering, et cetera, like modifying, building, manufacturing, et cetera. And I was having difficulty trying to describe it because there's like, this isn't just music. This isn't just computer science and engineering. Like, it all blurs together. So I basically settled on, well, makerspace culture kind of has some words that talk about it, but like, there wasn't like this definitive thing I could point to and say, this is X.
Yeah.
So like with STEM, like with the way you're describing it, it just made me think of the dissertation. Like, well, yeah, it's STEM, but it's also all these other things. So what do we call that?
And you threw that phrase makerspace and making and maker education. I think that's like the building step of the theoretical step that STEM often, you know, it's kind of like that's the action step behind the content step. Yeah, they're so linked together. You can throw project-based learning in there. You can throw design thinking in there. I mean, it doesn't matter what we call it in the end, as long as it's just good, relevant education, good, relevant learning for the kids.
One of the resources that you haven't talked much about, but I know just came out, is your new book. So it's titled Daily STEM, How to Create a STEM Culture in Your Classrooms and Communities. So I'm wondering if somebody asks you, well, what is the elevator pitch for this book? What would you say?
You know what? Number one, teachers always ask me the question, you know, how do I do STEM in my school? You know, how do we start STEM? Or we're doing STEM, how do we keep doing it? How can we make it better? And I always wanted to reply, and it was hard to reply in 280 characters all the time, or I found myself answering the same question over and over again. And it's like, there's got to be a quicker way to do this. So it was like, I want to help as many teachers as I can, because, you know, some people talk about, well, you could become a principal or, you know, things like that, and you could influence more people. It's like, no, I got to be in that classroom with the kids, because I love being able to just help those kids in that context. But I felt that if I took the opportunity to write a book, write all my thoughts about STEM and how to make it practical, just to help so many other educators out there think the strange way about STEM that I do, then that was going to help multiply the efforts, help educators out there realize that it's not just robots and rocket science. It's not just 3D printers. It's something that every teacher can do every day in every classroom with every kid, and not just in your own school culture, but drawing that out into the community as well.
So any large project like this that I've worked on, I've always learned like something just I never anticipated. I'm curious, when you were going through and writing this book, what's something that you learned while working on it?
Writing a book is hard. Writing a book is not something you do because you like want to get rich or you want to get famous. You really write it because you have a story to tell. And people have always been storytellers. And in fact, that was the part I actually like best about the finished product of the book. People have told me as they've read it, they're like, this reads like a story. It doesn't read like a college textbook that you would think of, but it's really meant to just remind people that we see STEM every day. It's part of the world. It's when we go to the grocery store. It's when we're cooking dinner together with our family, when we're fixing something around the home, when we do whatever type of job we have. The STEM is always there. And I just wanted to help readers, help educators especially, understand that STEM is just part of our everyday lives. How can we help kids to understand that as well? So it's hard to write a book, but in the end, when you have a story to tell as an educator, it's worth it because undoubtedly your story will impact other educators who feel the same way you do or just don't know, you know, what is it that I'm missing in my class? We all have so much to share. Yeah, that's why I love doing my podcast as well. And I'm sure same for you, Jared, because we love giving a platform to educators to share what's on their heart.
So what about educators who are interested in sharing what's on their heart and sharing their story, but they're like, okay, a book sounds like it would be interesting, but how do I honestly even get started with that? Like, do you have recommendations or I wish I hadn't done this when I started?
Well, number one, don't start when you're not ready. You know, if you open up a Google Doc and just start throwing in their thoughts, whenever you come across like an idea, something that you share and you feel like it really resonates either with your classroom or like you share something on social media and all of a sudden like 200 people retweet it and you're like, what the heck? How did that happen? You know?
Right.
You start just grabbing those pieces and say, that's something that you feel in your heart. If you have the opportunity to present, you know, at small conferences, I love any chance that I get, you know, big conference, small conference. In fact, I love just any opportunity to be able to share with educators and also listen to other educators. So share whatever it is that's on your heart, what your passion is for making education better. Write a blog, hop on a podcast, you know, send an email to somebody and say, hey, I love your podcast. You know, would you let me come on it? You know, I mean, most podcasters are always willing to do that. So,
yeah.
But just start to say, what is it that I'm passionate about? What do I feel like really makes a difference in the lives of my kids? And then just start finding ways to share it. It doesn't have to be in a book. If it ends up being in a book someday, that's great, but it doesn't have to be.
I like that. So you had mentioned earlier that like the learning process is iterative. You're just constantly refining things and whatnot. I'm wondering, how do you personally iterate on your abilities, whether it's as an educator, as somebody who understands STEM, or as like somebody who hosts their own podcast or has written a book? Like, how do you essentially practice and improve in any of those areas that interest you?
Jared, what you're asking about is like, do we still have that growth mindset as an educator and or that continuous, that lifelong learning? Just yesterday, the person who came to the house that we bought happened to have a sprinkler system. I never would have paid for a sprinkler system to be put in, but the house already had it. So it's like, okay, I got to have somebody come and winterize it, and blow all that water out of that, which I can understand the science of that because, you know, as something freezes, it expands and you don't want to expand and break all those pipes underground. So as the person is there, I could have just said, all right, thanks. Let me know when it's done, you know, and I'll give you the check. But no, I was right there asking him questions about how he's doing it. Why does it work? You know, what's this process? You know, why are you doing it like that? How big of an air compressor do you need? And actually I found out that when it's not irrigation season, you know, in the summer, he works with statistics. He has a degree from a university and does statistics work actually at the university that you graduated from. So, you know, you never know who you're going to learn something from.
Yeah.
Again, it comes down to being a good question asker. And I think educators are good at that. Be willing to ask and listen, not just tell everything, you know, that you want to say, but ask other people, find out about them. People love talking about themselves. That's why you got me on the podcast. I'm just talking about myself, Jared.
Well, I am directing a lot of questions at you. So
yeah, that's good.
I heard similar advice from an advisor of mine saying the quality of questions that you ask is going to have a huge impact on yourself, your career, like everything that you want in life. So I used to write down like every question that I had after reading an article or a chapter or something. Or when I engage in a conversation, I'd write down questions that led to really good conversations and whatnot. And I'd analyze them. What worked about this? What didn't work about it? And try and get better at it. So I second that and like really like that.
Again, it relates back to what I mentioned earlier. A simple thing that educators can do is having kids, when they come up with a question, something that they're interested about, you know, again, have them write it down. It's that same thing.
I'm curious, how are you taking care of yourself in order to prevent like the burnout and just like the overwhelm that is 2020 or just teaching in general? Because you've been doing this for a while and a lot of educators usually end up leaving the field after just a few years. So what have you done in the long term and now in 2020 to prevent that burnout?
Yeah, great question, Jared. Number one, you got to make sure you spend time with your family, your friends, your loved ones. Just make sure that you're just spending that good quality time with them. Play games, call grandma, call grandpa, call whoever, you know, use that phone for something besides, you know, chatting and texting and TikToking. But honestly, the biggest thing that keeps me going as an educator is being part of a team of educators. Now, right now, my school is 100% virtual. And so trying to connect with my fellow educators, it's a little bit more of a challenge, but we have a group text, we have Microsoft Teams, we have, you know, all these different ways that we can just stop and ask each other questions when we're struggling and ask those other teachers around you, are you struggling? You know, hey, can I help you with anything? How's it going? You know, you're a first year teacher. How's it going? That's such a powerful question that any educator that's been teaching a while can ask. That's probably the most important question. And then also, like just today, I posted in our Microsoft Teams. I was like, hey, it's Friday. You know, it's so great working with all of you. You know, just keep up the good work and enjoy your weekend. Did I have to do that? No. Did anybody tell me to do that? No. I just did it because, hey, I'd want someone to do that for me. And number two, knowing that I did that also, I think, reminds me that I'm doing a good job too, and we can all encourage each other. So that's the biggest thing. If we can just keep on encouraging each other, and again, especially look out for those new teachers, those young teachers and things like that.
That resonates with some practices that I've been doing. Like ever since I got into the classroom, I realized that when a kid would just like say, thank you, hey, you had an impact, I really appreciate it. Like I realized I never voiced that enough to some of the teachers who had such a profound impact on my life, and have like since that reflection, like been like, okay, whenever I do like a gratitude meditation, I'm actually going to go and reach out to that person that I was thinking about. Hey, I'm really grateful that I got to know you, etc. It's a powerful practice.
Or actually, one of the things that I learned while writing a book, when you write that acknowledgments page, that's something that every teacher should do all the time. Like think about who are those people that if you were writing a book today, who would go on your acknowledgments page? And don't wait until you write a book to say thank you to those people.
So one of the things that has been brought up in a lot of the interviews and like some of the articles that I've unpacked in the podcast is there's an equity and inclusion issue in CS and STEM and whatnot. I'm wondering if you have any advice on how to improve those areas.
You know, we talk and the research is out there on, you know, helping every kid to be able to engage in the STEM opportunities. And it's going to take some time, I think, for us to see those things, especially when we look at job numbers, when we look at career numbers, how many people are in particular fields. Those things aren't going to change. And we almost, as educators, can't worry about those numbers right now. What we can worry about is the 20, the 30 kids that are in my classroom right now. If I'm making sure that I'm engaging every single one of those kids, and again, you know, I love sports, but if all I did was ever share sports examples connecting to my subject and making it relevant by saying, oh, this was cool, I saw this, and only talking to, you know, engaging those athletes in my classroom, then I'm missing out on all those other kids with the other interests. So
yeah,
again, I think that focus on kids' interests and passions has the ability to completely erase any levels, any boundaries from any kid engaging in STEM learning. I think that's the critical way that we can all get every kid to be excited about whatever it is that we're learning. Again, whether it's the STEM field or whether it's computer science, whether it's anything, if we can just help kids connect with their learning, their passions, their interests, that to me is what's going to do it. And again, also the more that we can help parents and families at home support education. And you know what? That might end up being one of the biggest things that happens in education through 2020 and all the distance and remote learning. Parents taking a bigger chunk, a bigger interest in their kids' education, because right now they get to see it up close and, you know, firsthand, and realizing how important that education is. So
yeah, that's a good point. And I like that you focused on the individual. How can you make things more relevant for each student rather than focusing on the broader demographics? That's a very important point.
Because again, we've always said it, every kid is unique. Every kid is special. Every kid is so incredible. I think back to what my interests were. Would a teacher have caught all those interests and inspired me? I don't know. You know, like you said, Jared, like certain teachers that just really resonated with you, really connected with you. And oftentimes it's because they took an active notice of what our interests were.
Yeah, even if I ultimately did not go down that particular field of study, like just to be able to connect it with my areas that I was interested in, it made me had a better appreciation for like both disciplines or subject areas. What do you wish there was more research on that could inform what you do in the classroom or with kids?
Honestly, if there was better research on that home, that family connection. And that could even be something that we as educators can do each and every day. You know, it's one of the things that I pointed out in my book. Just like survey the parents in your school. And whether that's a formal survey, like sending out a Google form, or whether that's just asking all of them when they come to your parent-teacher conferences, you know, what kind of things do you do with your kids at home? Hey, would you like some more ideas? How good do you feel like you are as a math or science student? You know, because I've for years had parents show up to my parent-teacher conferences and they say, oh, I was a terrible math student. And that's why my kid isn't a good math student. No, it's not genetic. You know, it's not like you passed it on like, you know, some sort of, you know, widow's peak on your hair. You know, it's not the same thing. So don't transfer that on to your kid. Every parent wants their kid to be a great reader. You know, nobody says, oh, I wasn't very good at reading, so my kid can't read. You know, nobody would say that. But if they say it about math, they seem to think it's okay. We need to help parents realize, no, talk about in a positive way. Say, you know, I might not have been good at math, but I want to get better. And I keep getting better. And I know you can be good at these subjects. So, and especially then you know which parents maybe to give more encouragement to if you have some idea of which ones maybe feel confident with STEM subjects or with whatever subject it is that you're teaching.
Yeah, that definitely resonates with me. Like the overall like approach that you use with daily STEM and connecting things to the real world and the everyday and whatnot. I could see that being extremely helpful, especially for parents who have that more of that fixed mindset of like, well, I was always bad at this. And then they have a kid who's coming in like, hey, I want to do this thing at home. By connecting it with the real world and to simple everyday things that you engage in, I could see that really kind of winning people over and going, oh, this is something that I can learn alongside with my kid.
Yeah, we can mix up the recipe for chocolate chip cookies. We can double the recipe and we've just done multiplication, you know, but you're doing multiplication with fractions because everybody knows there's fractions when you're measuring things out in a recipe. And just reminding parents that that's what it is and to give a little nod of encouragement to that. And again, parents, families will start to realize, hey, that's something I can do.
Are there any questions that I haven't asked that you want to talk about?
You know, if I had to say one last thing to just remind educators, just try something new today, try something new this week. And whether it fails or whether it succeeds, your kids are still going to learn from it. And if you're willing to accept a little bit of failure and along with the success, then that's also an important skill that those kids are going to learn as well with you.
So where might people go to connect with you and check out all the free resources that you create?
Free resources are at dailystem.com. And if they go on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, it's Daily STEM. And I'm always happy to help. I especially love it when people have questions. I love being able to help people because, again, I can talk about all sorts of great ideas, but they may not work in every single context. And I think that's also making STEM just practical and relevant. That's also the power that it has to help kids in every single context.
And with that concludes this week's episode of the CSK8 podcast. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Chris, and I hope you take a moment to check out all of the free resources that Chris provides on his website, as well as his new book. Seriously, there's a ton of content on there. Stay tuned next week for another Unpacking Scholarship episode, and stay tuned 2 weeks from now for another interview. I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.